Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today we'll visit about woody ornamentals and plant diseases. Well, we're focusing first here on plant diseases. Brian Huddleston with me in the studio, plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison Extension. Laura Jull's not with us yet. She's our woody ornamental specialist, but she may be coming in at some point here, Brian. Maybe she's just got an early start on the 4th of July.
No, she may be looking for parking. That may be the challenge, because she's probably driving in from home in Sun Prairie, so would be my guess.
Yeah, there's lots of road construction, street construction.
Pretty bad down here on campus right now, so.
Yeah, it is, and I hope you have a good 4th of July weekend.
Thank
plan.
You. You taking care of dogs for my parents, so that's the challenge for the weekend.
We'll be watching some fireworks in Watertown and Madison. Jim Packard's off. I think Jim left his car running so that after the show he could just race right out there
and
not
jump
waste.
Right in and not waste any time. Good for him.
Oh, boy. I tell you what, we'll have some fun today, and we'll try. We have a couple of people on board already with questions. Let's focus on the plant diseases. We'll try to answer some of the other things as well as we move along here. But if you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Martin in Dodgeville up first. Hi, Martin. Thank you for calling.
It's Marlon, but that's
Marlon.
Okay.
Hi, Marlon. How are you?
Thank you. Well, I'm fine. I think that the show is actually serendipitous to my problem, because I've just noticed a maple that looks like it has a disease of some sort.
Okay.
It's the manifestation is, it looks like there are many little worms sticking up on the tops of the leaves. They are not worms. They're just little growths of some
kind. Yeah, those are actually insect galls, and it's a wasp of some kind that will lay her eggs in the tissue, and that'll stimulate what's basically what's called a gall. It's just kind of a mass of plant tissue. It's called a gall, G-A-L-L. The little tiny thin ones that you're seeing, if they're very, very long, and oftentimes they kind of hang down from the bottom surface of the leaf, those are called spindle galls.
Okay.
And again, it's a cosmetic problem. We don't worry too much about them. You see them sometimes one year, sometimes not another. It's hard to predict when they will be a problem. And once you start to see the galls, it would be too late to do any treatment anyway. And we usually don't recommend any sort of insecticide treatment for those.
Is it
nonetheless?
Will it wreck the tree?
No, not at all.
It looks pretty ill. It looks pretty sick right now.
Yeah,
the leaves are kind of wimpy, and there are perforations in the leaves.
Now, there can be other things that might be going on in addition to the galls that could be stressing your trees. So some of the things to keep in mind, if the leaf size is a little bit smaller than what you would expect, is that correct?
Yeah, actually, it's planted in poor soil.
Okay.
But I've been caring for it, and I put it in a couple, 3 years ago.
Okay.
It's maintained itself over that time. I've fertilized it with spike fertilizers.
Okay. Usually a better option when you transplant a tree is to hold back on the fertilizer.
Well, I did. I waited a couple
of
years.
And actually watering is probably the primary thing that we would recommend for a newly transplanted tree. And I kind of define newly transplanted as anything that's been planted within about the last three growing seasons.
Yeah, and mine has, I think this tree has a particular problem because the soil is rocky and difficult for the leaf or for the root structure to take hold.
Right. So definitely make sure that tree is getting plenty of water. We've had a lot of rain recently, so it's not as critical for watering. But now that it's in its roughly third year in the ground, I would say about an inch of water per week. And I would use a soaker hose for that. And
for the amount of water that we've been having, is there like a...
You're in Dodgeville, so you've been getting a lot of water.
A lot of water right recently, yeah. But as we get into the drier part of the summer, if it starts to dry out, it'll still be pretty important to keep that tree well watered. Some of the shredding that you're seeing in the leaves, depending upon when that happened, there could be insect feeding that could cause some of that look to the leaves. There could be there could have been some cold injury to the leaves as they were emerging in the spring that will lead to a phenomenon called tatters, which will give the leaves a very, very shredded sort of look. There are other things possibly that could cause that sort of shredding to the leaves. But with a small leaf size, I think it's probably just the tree getting established in its location. You need to get it to form a really good root system. And once it gets established, I would think those leaves would get a little bit larger.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Marlon, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to Mary in West Bend. Mary, hi.
I had a question about a tree seedling, but I'll also maybe ask a pathology question of Brian since he is here today.
Sure.
My pathology question would be, is it possible to do a sample on mulch to know if it's carrying any kinds of diseases?
It's very, very difficult to do that sort of testing. Okay. What sort of mulch are you using?
Well, I emailed you a while back. We had some problems at our community garden with some pepper plants.
Okay.
That I sent a picture in, and so the gardener replanted the plants and had the same thing happen again.
Okay.
So then we had him take the plants out, put them in pots with some soil that wasn't there, and remove all the mulch.
Okay.
And he did mention that when he put down a bale of marsh hay that there was some mold in it.
Yeah.
And was wondering if that could have been part of his problem.
Probably not. There's a possibility, but keep in mind that any of the mulches that you're putting down, that's dead plant material.
Right.
And so it's going to be colonized by a lot of different types of fungi that don't cause disease. So they're going to be these organisms that just kind of rot the material, and that's why you have to continually replace mulches. These typically are not disease-causing organisms, so I wouldn't expect that to be the problem. With peppers, what I would worry about there, if they're just kind of wilting and dying back, would be verticillium, which is a soil-borne fungus. You can bring that in on certain types of hardwood mulches. If there's a lot of ash or maple content, and
he had chopped up leaves from his yard.
Okay, that could possibly be a source.
I didn't think that was the cause of it, but you never know.
You never know. Verticillium can come in on leaves. It's been reported to actually form little rusting structures in the petioles, that little stem portion of the leaf. So you can certainly get it in on leaf litter as well. I tend to recommend composting material. The question with verticillium, because it does form this little resting structure, is exactly how long to compost, and that isn't well documented at this point.
All right.
Once you have verticillium around, it tends to stick around in the soil, and it also tends to, because it has such a wide host range, it can survive in weed species in your garden, so you tend to have it for an extended period of time. That's certainly a possibility.
All right. Well, thank you very much. My other question was about a seedling of a concolor fir, but I don't know if that's your area of expertise.
Go ahead and ask it.
Laura's here. Laura just joined us, and Laura Jowell, associate professor and extension specialist for Woody Ornamentals, on board. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you? And sorry I'm a couple minutes late. Your elevator is not working, so I had to climb up 7 flights of stairs. So I'm a little out of breath.
And furthermore, the chiller is down, so we have no air conditioning in the building.
It's hot up here. The sweat lodge.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, go ahead with that question, Mary.
I have a seedling of a concolor fir that appeared in my garden. I think it's probably around 3 years old. The stem, the trunk is about maybe 1/2 inch around. And I'm wanting to obviously put it someplace else. Do I need to put it in a pot for a while, or shall I just put it where I want it to be?
You can put it where you want it to be.
Okay.
Yeah, make sure you water it often, because this is a transplant. We're getting into the hottest part of the year.
Mm-hmm. And would it be better to do that in fall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like September.
That. All right, very good. Thank you very much for your time.
Yep, thanks for calling. And Wendy in Watertown, on to you now. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, I had a quick question about strawberries.
Okay.
We have a pretty big patch of strawberries in our garden, and we did okay this year, but we had something funky going on. I don't know if it was environmental or if it was a disease, but some of the strawberries turned out great, but on the same plant we'd have berries that were covered in like a thick brown gray, almost like a dust, if that makes sense.
Okay.
And I don't know, like I said, I don't know if it was a disease or if just all the water, some of them got kind of moldy, but it didn't just look like mold. It was like if you touched them, the dust would kind of go like poof up in the air.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's something I need to worry about for next year, or if it was just a fluke this year.
Did the fruit seem fairly firm underneath that brown dust?
I'll be honest, it was kind of yucky, so I tried not.
See, now this would be something I'd go poking around in, because I think this sort of stuff is cool. I'm speculating here, but one of the things that I have seen, I saw some beautiful pictures that came through We have an online diagnostic service through UW Extension. It came through that service. There was a slime mold, and this is a little fungus-like organism. Okay. They aren't pathogens, so they don't cause disease, but what they do is they grow on plants, and they use them as a growth surface. And this one had little tiny, they almost look like insect eggs on little white stalks. Eventually, those are going to, those little brown things are going to burst open. They're going to be filled with brownish powder. So it may be that you saw the end stage of that particular slime mold. I'm trying to remember, see if I can remember the name of the white.
Yeah, because I really wasn't in there until it was time to pick. You know, like my husband's the gardener. I was just picking, so I wasn't in there. You know, kind of early in the season. So
definitely we've seen a lot of slime mold activity this summer, early spring or late spring and early summer because of how much rain we've had. So it may very well be. And this is one that tends to cause a few problems on strawberries. It doesn't, like I say, infect the plant or cause a disease, but it can make the fruits look very unattractive and it can get on the leaves as well. And it interferes with photosynthesis. So, but it's not anything to be overly concerned about. Just stay away from those fruits. And if it is a slime mold, you may see it next year. You may not. It'll depend on the weather that we have.
All right.
Okay, so there's not really anything to do about it, just hope for a little less rain.
No, and I really like slime molds. I have to say they're probably my favorite group of organisms because they're really, really cool.
They're also good for jam, though.
That's true. That's true. But if you've ever seen the movie The Blob, that creature from that movie was basically patterned after a slime mold. Yeah. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks a lot for calling.
I know I'm geeky, but those are just pretty
movie.
Cool. Cool.
Oh, man.
Organisms.
Well, let's see. What do we got here? Mark in Sheboygan. Let's go to you, Mark. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I'm calling about a Russian olive tree. It bloomed earlier this year, but then all the flowers died off and nothing came, no fruit came from it.
Okay.
I'm trying to find out what might have caused that.
Where are you in the state, first of all?
Sheboygan Falls.
Sheboygan Falls.
Okay. First of all, that's actually probably a good thing because Russian olive is a highly invasive plant and the birds eat the fruit and they fly away, they drop the seed and up comes a new Russian olive. Is it now illegal to sell or transport Russian olive? I personally would get rid of the plant entirely. I'm sorry to say, but it really is quite an invasive species.
Well, yeah, I know that we have to cut back about every 2 years. We have to go back in and cut out all the little ones that are starting to shoot up.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just trying to,
It could be due to frost damage. It could be due to lack of pollination.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It might be frost. But I was wondering if there's anything else that might have caused the blooms. Because it was just the blooms. The rest of the leaves and everything in that are fine.
Yeah.
When did you notice the symptoms? When did you notice the flowers?
Just last. It was about a month ago.
Yeah.
Could have been some cold injury.
The other question I have was, where should you top an apple tree? I mean, when you're topping an apple tree to stop the growth from going up,
You should never top a tree. Topping can cause significant damage to a tree. It's not a proper pruning cut, and diseases can, since there's not a branch crotch union right there. Diseases and pathogens can move right down the stem. It is really not an appropriate way to prune any tree.
So what you want to do is take off whole branches, I would expect.
Yeah, I would bring the branches back to a node, meaning back to where another branch is coming out. Don't leave any stubs and don't flush cut either. I do have an extension fact sheet on the
Wisconsin Horticulture website, and that's wihort.uwex.edu. If you go to our Wisconsin Garden Facts section, which is the first entry in our main menu, look under General Horticulture. There's a fact sheet on how to properly prune trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's really important.
Right.
You really want to do that right.
Yeah.
So what's that address? Do the address again.
It's wihort.uwex.edu, and that's the UW Extension Horticulture website. And the first entry in the main menu is our Wisconsin Garden Facts listing.
Yeah.
And we have about 200 titles in that particular group of fact sheets. There's also a very good apple care extension bulletin that's available. You could get that at the Learning Store. It's Learning Store, all one word, learningstore.uwex.edu. And just do a search on Apple, and you should be able to come up with several publications that deal with apple trees. And there's one specifically that'll have some more detailed information on pruning fruit trees, particularly apple trees.
Guarantee you're going to be a lot happier with your tree.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Mark. Thank you. Thanks for calling. Arlen in Potosi, on to you now. Thank you for waiting. Hello.
Oh, hello, Larry.
Hi. What can we do for you?
I got a couple questions. My first question is, I go out in the woods in the fall and do a little ball. And anyway, I've noticed this tree up behind my house that's about 40 inches in diameter. And about 30 feet up in the air, there's white stuff around it. I don't know what it is, but as I was watching this for the last several years, that white stuff started to not go down the trunk, but went up the trunk. And I'm not sure what the species of the tree is either, but last year when I was sitting there swaying back and forth in the wind, all of a sudden I heard this crack, and right where all that white fungus or whatever it was, the tree split there and fell over.
Yeah, it's probably one of the heart rot fungi. These are fungi that form what we call shelf fungi. They produce reproductive structures that are kind of shelf-like, and you were probably seeing one of those. And that tree was probably infected. It may have gotten wounded at some point. The fungus got in through the wound or somehow got into the tree around that point where you were seeing all of that white material. And these fungi oftentimes will rot the wood. And that's probably what happened in this case. It weakened it enough so that a wind came through while you were sitting there, and it just broke that branch off. So you may continue to see some of that white material around that area where the fracture occurred. And if you're interested, if you can collect any of that, you can get it into my lab and we can have it identified for you. Or if you have a digital camera and think you can get a picture of it, you could certainly email it to me as well.
Okay, but this is the whole tree that fell over.
Yeah. Okay, it could be that there was infection all the way down to the base of the tree, quite frankly. That does occur with some of these fungi. And what you were basically seeing was that all that white material you were seeing on the outside of the tree, that's a very small portion of the actual fungus that's in the tree. It's kind of like you're seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Fortunately, you weren't in the tree at the
time. Yes, or under the tree.
That's right, yeah. I did something right, I got away from him. I went to a different tree besides that one, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, there was a situation in Monona, Wisconsin, several years ago where there was a tree that failed.
Honey locust.
Yeah, it was a honey locust, and a driver in a car was crushed. So that sort of thing can happen. So definitely if you see these sorts of growths on the tree, you should be kind of cautious around that tree because that tree is probably compromised and weakened.
Oh, I didn't go near it.
Okay, okay, sounds good.
Thanks, Arlen, for calling. Appreciate it. Ryan in Chilton, we're on to you. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. I had a question about a wild parsnip.
Okay.
And pulling alongside the road one day and noticed at the very topmost of the flower umbel, a worm had taken, or a worm or a grub of some sort, had started eating down there and was making nests and whatnot. And I was just wondering, is there any known bug or thing that's specific to wild parsnip?
There probably are, but I'm neither Laura nor I are experts on those. If and listen to my whole comment here before
don't
you
touch
do this.
It.
Yeah. if you can find some of the larvae, you can collect them and get them down to our insect diagnostician or get a photograph of them and email them to him. Or you could submit these to your county extension office. You could get an identification. If you're going to collect them, be very, very careful. The sap of part wild parsnip can cause a dermatitis, very similar to poison ivy. You get the sap on you and then you get exposed to light. And it's a plant not to play around with.
No.
The burns can be quite bad.
I have the scars to prove it from previous years.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
The blisters can last for months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And I must say, I have to talk to our grounds folks here on the campus because I take one of the new paths, bike paths, to walk home. And there's a wild parsnip along that hanging over the lane. So I want to tell them to make sure they get rid of that. So.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Laura Jowell and Brian Huddleston, our guests on this edition of Garden Talk. Jim Packard, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take your question about woody ornamentals or plant diseases with Laura Jowell and Brian Huddleston as our guests on Garden Talk here. The number 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Don in Elkhorn, we turn to you now. Hi, Don.
How you doing?
Good.
Say, last year I turned two horseshoe pits into a couple of asparagus beds. I dug the sand out, turned the soil over about a foot deep, worked it up real well, planted the put the plants in probably a little deeper than what I should have, maybe 4 inches instead of the 2 they recommended. And I didn't expect anything the first year. I did buy two-year-old plants instead of 1-year-old plants, which was an option. And I expected that this year being the third year that I'd be able to harvest, but they come up pencil lead thin, and only about half of them came up. And I called the seed company, and they warrantied them, sent me another half. I replanted and put in with some fertilizer, which was a combination of blood meal, kelp meal, bone meal, and poultry fertilizer, which the raccoons in my area found particularly attractive, and they dug all the plants up and ate the fertilizer. So now I got two questions. What's wrong with my plants that they're acting so immature, you know, and not progressing like I expect them to, and what can I fertilize them with that the raccoons won't find irresistible?
Yeah, I can't really comment on the fertilization issue, but what I would suggest is to, as you're digging out those plants, take a look at the crowns to see if you see any discoloration or any decay. From a disease standpoint, what I would worry about is that perhaps there was something in the soil that will infect the crowns and roots and could cause some inhibition of water uptake and movement in the plant, and that would cause some the sort of stunting that you're describing.
So what do you recommend I do with them?
Just check the plants. If you're going to try to replace them again, just look for any rot or any decay in the crowns and roots.
Okay.
Yeah, the crowns and roots seem to be fine. If, you know, the coons dug those up for me, so I could close up.
How about the ones that you planted a couple years ago? When you replaced those, did you see any signs of discoloration in the roots?
No, they're brown just like they were when I planted them.
Okay. Were they soft at all? Could you tell?
I don't recall the texture.
Okay. Yeah, the only thing I can think of from a disease standpoint would be, you know, crown and root rots that would cause those sorts of symptoms. There might be some contaminant in your pits where you had your horseshoe pits that might be inhibiting growth as well. But that would require some soil testing in order to figure out if that's the case.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Don. And Sally in Wayland, Minnesota, we're on to you now. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jim. Thank you, and thanks to Laura and Brian.
Thank you.
I wanted to touch
back on the Russian olive. Mm-hmm. You said that it's illegal to sell them. Is that just in Wisconsin, or is that Minnesota too, or is it across the United States? And then my second question is regarding the bees. I'm a beekeeper, and I know beekeepers who say that bees really like Russian olives, so we're all interested in helping the bees. And I'm sorry to hear that Russian olives are so invasive, but if it helps the bees, is it worth having them?
No. In regards to your first question, it's illegal in Wisconsin, not Minnesota. I don't know Minnesota laws. It's part of the NR40 ruling about invasive species. And currently on the DNR website, if you Google invasive species, it will show you a list of many woody as well as herbaceous ornamentals that are considered now illegal to sell and transport. Buckthorn, for example, oriental bittersweet. See what else is on that list. The honeysuckles are all on the list, and Russian olive as well as autumn olive. In regards to bees, yeah, I'm a big bee fan. I really do like having bees in my yard. Without bees, we wouldn't have most of our fruit that we eat today require bee pollination. Now, there are lots of other plants that attract bees besides Russian olive that are not invasive. Many of our perennials, flowers that attract butterflies also attract bees. There's also a number of woody ornamentals when they're in bloom, they attract bees. Apples, for example, crab apples, the bees love them. And those are much better species than Russian olive. Sorry to be a downer on Russian olive. But another problem with Russian olive is it's very disease prone.
Phomopsis canker. Fungal disease.
Yeah, Phomopsis canker, and they're short-lived species. They tend to look very ratty as they get older. If you'd like to see places where Russian olive really has spread in the environment, there's an interchange in Green Bay, and I forgot the names of the highways. It's right after, what's the city just south of Green Bay?
De Pere.
Just past De Pere, right when you get to that fork where you can go towards the airport, versus over that big bridge. There's a whole bunch of Russian olive right there that is invaded. It's everywhere in the state.
Yeah. Mm. There you have it, Sally. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call.
I have to say, if you have a larger Russian olive tree that you're going to be taking out, if you have a woodworker friend,
they might love to
have the wood because that's a stunning, stunning wood.
Deborah in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I'm in Brown Deer, and I for the past like 5 years, I've been watching these trees slowly but definitely become infested with something that looks like mealybug on a large scale. And these are beautiful old, like 40 to 50 year old, like I think stone pine trees. I haven't identified them perfectly yet. And so I wondered what that was, and I just want to tell the person who I just want to say I've had photodermatitis, but I got it from Joe Pieweed, and right now I have poison ivy, and I think I'd rather have the photodermatitis.
Although the stuff that I've seen with poison parsnip or wild parsnip is really, really bad, and there's also a plant called hogweed, giant hogweed, which is really even worse.
Really bad.
Really, really bad if you get that. I'm thinking maybe it could be a scale insect that you're seeing on the pine, although, again, I'm not an insect expert, so this would be something where I would recommend if you can get a branch or some of the needles that are showing this white material, get it into your county extension office. V.J. Pandian is the horticulture agent up in your area. And if he doesn't know what it is, he can get it down to Phil Pelletieri, who's our insect diagnostician, and he can identify it for you.
It could be woolly aphids, too.
That's a possibility as well. Yeah. So.
Do they devastate the whole, like, whole branches?
They can if the populations are high enough.
They
tend to be a sucking insect, same with scale. They're not chewing. They're not actually chewing the needles. They're sucking the juice out of the plant, causing the branches to eventually die.
It's very sad to watch these trees die, but thank you so much.
I would definitely get a sample and see if you can get it identified, because you can control both of those if you know what it is.
Yeah, quite easily.
Bob in Iola, on to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good morning. Hey, just a quick aside on that wild parsnip. I've done some welding in the past. Wild parsnip is like hitting yourself with a blowtorch. That stuff is bad.
Yeah.
I'd stay away from it.
Yeah.
Hey, my question on late blight on tomatoes. Mm-hmm. We got wiped out last year about the middle of September. Mm-hmm. And is that overwinter?
Technically not here in the state unless you have live plant material. And where we would expect it to overwinter in the state would be in potato tubers. So if you were growing potatoes, that particular fungus, although it primarily hit tomatoes last year, it also does go to potato. And if it got into a potato plant and ended up in the tuber, and then you use that tuber as a source of your seed potatoes for this year, then you could have the fungus show back up and overwinter here in the state. We have not had any reports of late blight as of yet. I've not seen any reports at this time. I haven't checked my email this morning, so maybe something came through overnight. But we have not seen late blight. There is late blight in southern Michigan. I believe there was a report in Manitoba and also one in one of the Dakotas. So it's around us. And I think, you know, quite frankly, I'm very proud of how people here in the state dealt with late blight last year, because we had it all over the place and we were telling lots of folks how to clean up. And they seem to have done a very good job, because given the weather that we had in early June where it was so wet, if we had had a local source of the fungus, I think we would have seen disease early. At this point, we have not seen it. So I have a feeling that if we're going to get it this year, it's going to come in from an outside source, just the way that it did last year. But if you're growing tomatoes, because we have reports around Wisconsin, the recommendation is, if you're concerned about it, to go ahead and treat with fungicides, you can use either copper-containing products or products that contain chlorothalonil. And you need to make sure you get a brand, a product that's labeled for use on tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And most home gardeners would probably go with the copper-containing products. And if you're an organic producer, it would have to be one of the copper-containing products that you would be using.
Brian, you need to spray all the foliage?
Yes, these are what are called protectant fungicides, which means that they basically coat the surface of the plant. And if you miss part of the plant, that missed section of the plant is still susceptible to infection.
Thanks very much for calling, Bob. We had an email from Tom, who lives in northern Illinois, transplanted a red buckeye that was about 18 to 20 inches tall. Some of the leaves fell off, about a third of them, after brown spots appeared on the leaves. The other leaves remain with brown spots. The new stem and branches are green and appear healthy, some new ones that came on. Are the brown spots merely a consequence of stress from transplanting, or could this be a mold, a virus-causing problem?
Red buckeye, first of all, isn't real reliably hardy here in Wisconsin.
Actually, this was northern Illinois.
Northern Illinois. Okay, mm-hmm. You're right on the border for red buckeye. Red buckeye is a wonderful southeastern native species with beautiful red flowers that the hummingbirds just love. Most buckeyes and horse chestnuts are very susceptible to leaf blotch, and I don't know the pathogen.
The one that I'm most familiar with on that particular host is Guinardia.
Guinardia,
yeah.
Okay.
There are, I believe there's also a bacterial leaf blotch as well on that particular host, but the one I see most commonly is this Guinardia fungal leaf blotch.
And also the buckeye is probably suffering from transplant shock as well, because they are prone to drought stress issues when planting. They're hard to transplant. They tend to be more of a tap root species when they're young, and kind of a fleshy root system. They're not the easiest to transplant into a landscape. The best thing you can do is water it, make sure it does not dry out. It may drop some leaves. The whole thing is just to nurse it along this year, and hopefully next year it will look much better. How big is the plant currently?
Oh, we
About
lost
20
him.
Inches, I believe he said.
Yeah, it was 20 inches.
Oh, yeah, it's nice and small.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
For the leaf disease, my recommendation would be to clean up the leaf debris this fall. Just get it out of your yard. That's where these pathogens tend to overwinter. And hopefully, if we have less rain early on next year, you'll have fewer problems with that disease.
Mm-hmm.
Gene in Monona, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Good morning, people.
Morning.
My question is, Arborvitae pyramidalis that I planted in the mid-70s are now like 50 feet high, and I don't want them to grow any bigger, and how can I trim them and stop from growing anymore?
You can't. I mean, yes, you can you can trim them back, but boy, do they look terrible. I've seen people top them, basically, and it just looks,
horrible.
To be honest, ridiculous.
What about just the new growth of the top 6 inches, if you just cut that?
Yeah, but it's going to grow right back. I mean, Arborvitae, you know, they're going to want to grow taller. Usually, for that particular cultivar, 50, 60 feet is pretty max for those particular cultivars.
Oh, okay.
It's getting to the point where, I mean, I've never seen a 80-foot tall one in my life, though you never know.
You never
I'm
know.
Sure there's one out there.
Yeah. Does that hold true also for the evergreen techni trees, the techni?
Techni gets nowhere near that big. Techni arborvitae is about a 20 to 25 footer.
Yeah, they grow sideways more than up to. So just leave them alone.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. And on to Jim in New Berlin. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got a question on black walnut trees. I was told they have a spore that'll kill other plants. I've got a number of those that are close to some, about 20 feet away from some white pine trees and a couple of maple trees. Is that a problem?
Yeah.
What should I do with those black walnuts?
It's black walnuts as well as our native butternut, if you see any left around. They've pretty much disappeared. And to a much lesser extent, hickories, they're all in the same family. They contain a product compound called juglone. And this juglone is a natural product that's made by the plant. It's in the roots, it's in the leaves, it's in the nuts. It's pretty much throughout the entire plant. And what happens when sensitive species, not every plant, but sensitive species that grow near it, come across this compound that's excreted by the roots, for example, or it's in the fruit. And what happens is it causes almost like a cancer-like growth in the plants that are sensitive. It causes the xylem to do very weird things. And what happens is that eventually the xylem or water-conducting tissue in a plant closes up and the plant dies. Now, there are certain groups that are very susceptible to this juglone that's in the plant. Anything in the solanaceous family, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, and peppers. Do not plant near any black walnut tree. And the roots can stay there for many, many years, even after the tree is removed. So it could still be there. I had a gentleman one time call about mulching his vegetable garden with black walnut shells.
Oh, dear.
And he lost everything, unfortunately.
How about those white pines, though? I mean, will they be...
I'm not... positive off. I think they are sensitive.
I'm trying to pull out of my memory. We have a fact sheet on black walnut toxicity. You might want to look that up. And it's at our website that I gave out earlier. And we'll give out that website again before the end of the program.
Yeah, give it out right now.
Okay, wihort.uwex.edu. And then click on Wisconsin Garden Facts in the main menu, and then you can just do a little search on the following page to look for black walnut toxicity. And it's a two-sided fact sheet. The first side talks about the information that Laura just provided, and on the back we have a table with what we consider our best estimate of sensitive and tolerant plants. And I think most of the maples are fairly tolerant. Silver maple tends
conifers
to be...
conifers are sensitive.
Sensitive, yeah. And I think white pine was on the sensitive column, as I recall.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about woody ornamentals and plant diseases today with Laura Jowell from the Department of Horticulture, where she is a woody ornamentalist specialist, and UW Extension. Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Our guests here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for our guests, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Don in Partyville next. Hi, Don.
This is Dan.
Dan, all
Hi,
right.
Good morning. I got a couple questions, so I'll keep them short. Japanese knotweed, that's the bamboo?
Yeah. I know all about that one.
Is that illegal to sell? I was at a nursery the other day, and they were getting $10 a pop.
I don't know that one off the top of my head because that was on the herbaceous list, and I worked specifically with the woody list.
Okay.
I don't know for sure. It's horribly invasive.
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah.
Well, if I can sell that for $10 a pop, if there's any buyers out there.
Yeah, man, oh, man.
Oh, man.
I had someone who just begged me. I have it in my own yard. They begged me and begged me and begged me for some, and I refused to give them any.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's
How do
horrible
I get rid
stuff.
Of honeysuckle? I've been keeping them around out in my woods because of the bees. I've got some that are huge, and they just buzz every fall with the bees. But
yeah.
I had to get rid of them. What's the best way to keep them from coming back?
Best way to get rid of them, and I'm not a huge, you know, chemical person, so anybody calling to yell at me about this, it's war when it comes to buckthorn and honeysuckle. The best thing to do is, if you can, pull the plants out. Believe it or not, honeysuckle can be pulled out much more easily than buckthorn.
Okay.
Second, cut the stems off. If you can't pull it out, cut the stems at the base of the plant and immediately treat with a systemic herbicide.
Like Roundup.
And follow directions for cut stump applications.
Okay.
And it's right on the label.
All right.
There's also Garland 4 that can be used as well. But if you cut the stump and then wait an hour or two, it's not going to translocate down to the root system as well as if you spray it immediately. And you just need to go around the outer edge of the branch and on top of the cut stem.
And if you're going to use a Roundup or a glyphosate product, make sure you get a formulation that is labeled for use as a cut stump product. Some of them are not.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, last question. I don't know if you can answer this. A lady a couple calls ago mentioned that Joe Pye causes dermatitis.
Mm-hmm.
I have a native garden and I put two plants in there. Do I need to watch that?
I would certainly be cautious. Quite frankly, different people have different reactions to to different mm-hmm. plants, so it really varies. Yeah. Some people can touch a particular plant and it does nothing at all, and someone else is sensitive. So, you know, just be cautious if you're gardening and start to see problems with dermatitis. Okay. You may have to investigate to see which of the plants that you're growing might be causing the problem.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Have a good day.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you as well. Susan in Menominee, on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Yes, good morning. My concern is my river birch.
Okay.
It's got fuzzy red fuzzies coming on the leaves of it. I've been told it's a mite and that I need to put coffee grounds around the base of my tree and dig them in. It's about 20 feet high, and I would like to know the cause, the cure, the prognosis. And if coffee grounds are the answer, how much?
I've never heard that particular treatment. It's probably is one of the mite galls. It looked like kind of a little fuzzy pink carpeting on the leaves. Yeah. I believe that's one of the mite galls. Again, this is Phil Pelletieri's ballyhoo, but we've seen a lot of that coming into our clinic, and we just walk it up to Phil, and we've heard him talk about this. It's a cosmetic problem. Mm-hmm. We've just seen a lot of it this year.
Yeah.
I don't think any sort of treatment at all is needed, quite frankly.
No, it's completely cosmetic. And it's too...
You may not see it next year.
Yeah, it's too late to spray for it because it's already here.
Yeah, once you start to see the symptoms, it means that the damage is already done. So
But the tree is probably going to live, and I'll just wait and see if it happens.
I would be much more
year.
Concerned if you were talking about a birch that had a lot of branch dieback, because then we mm-hmm. would start talking about bronze birch borer, and that can be a problem on particularly white-barked birches.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, thanks much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Dave in Sauk City emailed us, and he says, I have a bunch of sour and sweet cherry trees planted in well-drained soil. They're entering bearing stage or age. This year, one of the sweet cherry trees produced a big crop, but the fruits were rotted on one side. First, I thought it was a mechanical damage from bird pecks or insects, but it ended up about 90% of the fruit on that tree was suffered from it. The sour cherries were not affected. Some plum trees had the same problem with more visible fungal or mold problems. What might be the cause? And what do I do next year to prevent this? He has about a dozen cherry and a dozen plum trees.
Yeah, if there's a lot of, if the fruits are actually rotting on the tree, if they've developed pretty fully and have started to ripen and then all of a sudden start to rot, actually what the disease I'm thinking of will cause the fruits to mummify eventually. If you're seeing kind of a buff-colored kind of powdery material on the surface of the fruits, it's actually fungal spores. It could be a disease called brown rot. It's very common on the pit fruits, so cherries, plums, peaches. It's a fungal disease, and the fungus will cause the fruits to mummify. A lot of those mummies will eventually drop to the ground, and once they're on the ground, they get covered with a little bit of soil, and then they'll sprout a little mushroom-like structure in the spring, and that's what starts the disease all over again. So it's going to be fairly critical, if it is this brown rot disease, to clean up all of those diseased fruits, as many as possible, get the ones that are off the ground, and then you may need to consider a preventative fungicide treatment. I would check for the disease brown rot. I don't know specific products for this particular disease, but check for products at your garden center that are labeled for brown rot control on stone fruits. So that would be cherries, peaches, and plums. You're going to have to make applications probably early in the season as the fruits are forming to prevent these later season disease symptoms from developing.
All right. Let's turn to Rich in Glen Haven next. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I live in the middle of a mixed hardwood forest, a mature forest of oaks and maples and hickories. Mm. And around my house, I've got maybe a dozen or so mature white oaks. And the white oaks around the house seem to be having a tough year this year for some reason. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to figure out if it's something I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. How?
When they leafed out this spring, a lot of the leaves shriveled up and died, or just became very, I'll say, not good.
Okay.
Yeah. And a lot of secondary leaves then popped out, bright green leaves. And the canopy is just not as thick as it's been mm-hmm. in the past.
One question I have for you, was there any type of construction injury? Was there any digging around these trees?
Yeah, how recently did you build your house, or how recently was the house built?
The house has been here about 12 years. And yes, there's been construction around a few of the trees, but other ones that seem to be affected are quite a ways away from the construction.
Yes, some of the ones.
The one thing that's in common is I have planted grass around the trees that seem to be having a tough time. And I also use Roundup around the base of the trees, and I was wondering if that's a bad thing to do.
Well, when you apply Roundup, you need to keep it off of the trunk of trees at all cost. It's a systemic herbicide that can be transported, especially on younger trees at a thinner bark. I realize your oaks are older, but still, I would never spray that material on unless you're trying to kill the plant, per se.
Right.
Second thing, construction injury on oaks. Oaks are very, very sensitive to any type of vehicles being driven over its roots, as well as raising the grade, lowering the grade, cutting of roots. They're very sensitive to that. And you often see the symptoms 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the fact, depending on how badly it was injured.
Okay.
Third of all, grass is very competitive with tree roots for water and nutrient uptake. The trees that are struggling, I actually would get rid of the grass, put in bark mulch or leaf compost or something that is more organic that is actually helping the tree out, because grass will get any water that is available first before the tree will. And that's
all right.
Actually kind of counterintuitive. Third, there is anthracnose, which is the first thing I thought of.
Yeah, the fact that you're talking about the leaves kind of turning brown and not looking so good early on, and then the trees re-leafing, my suspicion is probably that those trees had anthracnose. It's a fungal disease that gets on the leaves. It's a very common disease, quite frankly, on a variety of different types of hardwoods. We saw quite a bit of it on oak this spring, and again, it's the amount that we see depends upon how wet it is in the spring. We had a fairly wet year this year, at least early on. So you probably were dealing with anthracnose. That's another disease where our primary suggestion for control is good fall cleanup of the leaves and removal of the infected material from your yard. That's where these anthracnose fungi will overwinter. You may still be seeing some effects, I think, from the construction damage, particularly if a tree is very near to a house. It may not have a substantial root system anymore on that side of the tree that's next to the house. The other thing I would watch for on these oaks is a disorder called chlorosis. And this is an iron deficiency in the tree. It's usually pH induced. Our soils tend to be relatively high in pH here in Wisconsin, and that will lock up iron so it can't be taken up by trees. And oaks are particularly sensitive to this particular disorder. The classic symptoms of chlorosis are light colored leaves, so they're light green or yellow with dark green veins. And if this disorder gets really severe, there will be some tissue death that occurs. And you can actually have branch dieback from this. So this would be a situation where you may want to consider a soil nutrient test, including a soil pH check, to see whether your soil pH is overly high or whether you need to be adding some iron to the soil.
Mm-hmm. One thing I want to mention is if you need some assistance, I'm not sure what area you're in.
Glen Haven.
Where's that? I'm not sure where that is.
It's near Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin.
Okay. Crawford County.
You can always go to the Wisconsin Arborist Association website. You just Google Wisconsin Arborist Association, and they have a certified arborist for hire link, and you can search by county and get a certified arborist to come to your house. And I do emphasize the word certified. They've actually passed a International Society of Arboriculture exam, and hopefully they're practicing good arboriculture practices, and they know what they're doing. They've had the educational background.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Oh, and by the way, speaking of arborists, Bruce Allison was on last week, and we were talking about mulching around trees. And he, as you recommended, the bark mulch, he particularly likes around trees because it kind of mimics what goes on in the forest.
It looks good.
And it looks good. Yeah, it looks good. And
just no volcanoes. Yeah. No bark touching the trunk of trees or shrubs.
And I don't like the rock mulch. I just think that you tend to get more problems with probably root heating under those sorts of mulches, and it just doesn't
rock
help.
Mulch?
Yeah, people use rock, crushed
like
rock.
Like pebbles
and that sort of thing, and also not very good for water retention. So,
my trouble is I've got about an acre around the house that's grass and trees.
Sure.
And so it's quite a bit of an area to mulch.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way the grass looks, but what I'm hearing is the grass is really not very good for the
trees.
It's
competing with your trees.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. And if you, you know, must maintain grass near there, at least put a bark mulch around, you know, the 2-foot diameter around the tree, but again, keeping it away from the trunk of the tree, no more than 2 to 3 inches.
We have lost a number of oaks in our area. Due to
oak wilt,
yes, mm-hmm. Sudden oak death. All of a sudden, that tree will just
up and
turn brown and die.
Probably not sudden oak death.
That's something different.
That's something very, very different, and we've never had a documented case of that particular disease.
But
in
oak
Wisconsin.
Wilt, we've had plenty of.
Yes, we have a lot of oak wilt. Yeah,
something else to
look out. You have to be careful calling something sudden oak death, because if it really is sudden oak death, you'll probably have people from the Department of Agriculture and the State Department of Agriculture and possibly even the FBI and Homeland Security out, because that's a pathogen that's on a select agent list.
Laura Zhao, our guest, and Brian Huddleston, our other guest, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Have to remind you that Wisconsin Public Radio has a day with the Brewers on August 12th, and you are invited to attend that. I'll be there, and Joy Cardine and Kathleen Dunn and Ben Marins, and we'll be celebrating our 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network. So we've got a tailgate from 11 to 1 or so. Game starts at 1:10. Actually, we've got a private outdoor pavilion for the pregame tailgate lunch, which will be a lot of fun. They're playing the Diamondbacks that day. The tickets themselves were worth $40. The event is $46. We'll have brats and sodas and potato salad, you know, the usual things. But we are also having a drawing for an autographed baseball, too. So that'll be fun. That's August 12th, but we're accepting tickets up until July 9th. We need to know by July 9th the number of people who will be attending. So reserve your tickets. Call Katie, and the number is 414-227-2047. That's 414-227-2047. Or go and take a look at my Facebook page or our WPR page, and you'll get the information from there. But it's August 12th. It's a Thursday. The Arizona Diamondbacks. Let's take some, I'll tell you what, we've got some open lines. I'll give you a call. Give us a call if you have a question for our guests today, Laura Zhao and Brian Huddleston, answering your woody ornamental and plant disease questions. The number is 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to John in Mineral Point. John, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. Would you guys be able to play Living on a Prairie by Bon Jovi?
No, we can't do that right now. Yeah, but I understand you have some worms in a tree, though, that you're worried about. No? All right. Well, goodbye. That's crazy. We have Ann from, you never know. Sometimes people get confused what they're listening to. Ann in Wausau says, I love the Pagoda Dogwood, but everyone I've seen in the Wausau area has the yellowish twig blight that eventually destroys the tree.
Yeah, one of the prettier diseases I get to deal with, but pretty deadly for the tree.
It's she says, I know the southern dogwood gets a leaf disease. I think it's anthracnose, mm-hmm. but what affects the pagoda and what can you do to control it?
Yeah, it's a disease that we affectionately call golden canker. The formal name is Cryptodiaporthe canker, after the name of the fungus that causes the disease. And it is characterized by the branches turning this kind of yellowish color. And then if you look very golden, and then if you look very closely on some of the branches, you may see little orange spots, which are the reproductive structures of this fungus that causes the disease. We tend to see this more on but go to dogwoods that are under some stress. And the typical stresses that I associate with seeing more of this golden canker are trees that are put in the wrong location. People love how pagoda dogwoods look. They have that wonderful straight branch architecture, which I just think is stunning. But what they do is they want everybody else to see that as well, so they put it out in the middle of their yard in the full sun, usually with a lot of grass up to the base. And that's a stressful location for pagoda dogwood. They like a lot of shade, cool roots. And so definitely if you've got a pagoda dogwood, put it in the right spot. So a shaded area, mulch around the base of the tree to keep the roots cool and make sure it's getting enough moisture. If you see the disease, prune it out. And that means pruning about 4 to 6 inches below where you see that gold color on the branch. And then make sure you disinfest your tools between cuts by dipping them in something like 70% alcohol or 10% bleach. I prefer the alcohol for metal tools. The bleach will tend to corrode them. And you can get rubbing alcohol. That will work. That's 70% alcohol in most instances. Also, a lot of the spray disinfectants will work as well.
David in Wauwatosa says, we have a 14-foot-high Siberian spruce. A falling branch from a nearby tree knocked off the top of the spruce's leader branch a week ago. Should we leave it alone or somehow address the situation so the tree will continue to grow in a normal manner?
Well, by having the terminal leader cut out or fallen off, broken off, the plant's going to want to establish a new leader. And this may take a number of years for it to take a lateral, and then all of a sudden the lateral branch will start to turn upright and grow like a terminal. That's what happens in nature. If you want that to happen sooner, you can, but again, this is very I have a lot of caution involved because you're climbing a very large tree. You need to safety equipment. Personally, I would get an arborist in there to do this for you, a licensed certified arborist. And what they can do is establish a new leader. They would have to somehow prop it up and secure it in place so that it's not girdling it either. And over the course of a number of years, that will lignify enough so that it doesn't need to be supported anymore and you'll have a new terminal leader. The only problem is that a new leader that you're propping up will be much more susceptible to wind damage, particularly in storms, as well as crows seem to like to hang out on the top of trees and they sometimes knock them off as well.
Rich and Nina, on to you. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I have an unusual maple tree. Basically, when the leaves come out in the spring, they're all green, but then half the tree turns yellow.
Okay, do you know what? Is this one of the Asian maples?
I'm not exactly sure which variety it is. It's quite an old tree, and it's been this way for many years, but it's got a relatively small leaf on it.
Okay. Is it half the tree, or the upper half, or the lower half, or is it side to side?
No, it's basically half. Split the, you know, up and down where, you know, a couple of, you know, it's got a few of the main leaders, but like two or three of them will have, are yellow.
And so the left side might be yellow and the right side of the tree might be green.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay. How big is this tree?
Oh, it's got to be about, on the stump, it's probably 18 to 20 inches.
Okay.
I mean,
It's a big tree.
You know, it's 40 feet tall, yeah.
Okay, it's not one of the Asian maples then. Most of those Asian maples, and it's not just Japanese, there's a bunch of them. Some of them have kind of a gold color to the leaf during the growing season, but that's not this. There's a couple things it could be. First of all, it could be a cultivar of a certain species, and again, you don't know which type of maple it is. There are some, that have kind of that coloring, but the first thing that comes into my mind is you have some type of either chlorosis issue going on, especially if it's a red maple. Red maples really must have acidic soils, and in the southern part of the state, I'm not sure where you're located, but in the southern part of the state, and as well as the eastern part of the state up to Green Bay, the soil pH tends to run more alkaline, which is above pH 7. And red maples notoriously in especially in backyards, are often yellow and chlorotic. And yes, it can occur on one side of the tree only. I have seen that where the leaves are turn yellow and the veins stay dark green. If that is the situation, which is more than likely what's wrong, then we need to concentrate on lowering the pH of the soil, first of all, but that takes a long time to do because you can add sulfur, but the microbes in the soil need to work on it to start to lower the pH. The other thing that we can do is actual tree injections at the root flare, right at the base of the tree, done by a certified arborist. Again, I recommend hiring them because they know how to do it. There's a special type of drill bit you need to use, as well as the product. They can get a hold of it. Again, if you want to go online to Wisconsin Arborist Association under Certified Arborist for Hire and search your county. I think you're in, are you in Outagamie?
It's Winnebago.
Winnebago. Okay, you're real close. There's a bunch of them in that, yep, that service, that area, that I would recommend.
All right.
I get a little nervous about those injection treatments because you're opening a wound in the tree.
Yeah, but I've seen the wound. The new bits that are used are very, very small. Mm-hmm. They don't go in very far. And a lot of times you can get 2-3 years. Mm-hmm. The main issue is right plant, right place.
Right.
And lowering that pH. Get rid of the grass growing underneath that tree because, again, it's very competitive for nutrient and water uptake. Put in bark mulch. Keep it away from the trunk of the tree. Add elemental sulfur. The rates are on the bag. And it's going to take time. Red maples, you can do foliar sprays of micronutrients such as iron. Actually, when it comes to red maple, it's not iron. It's actually manganese, MN, that's causing the chlorosis issues, not iron. And by adding iron, you just make the problem worse, more chlorosis, because iron and manganese compete for root uptake.
Yeah, I would really suggest a soil nutrient test and pH test before you do any of the, particularly the sulfur addition, just to see where you are pH-wise. And then based on that recommendation or that pH reading that you get from the soil test, then you can apply the appropriate amount of sulfur.
But I also would do a foliar test, too.
Yes, yes. We usually recommend both the soil and the tissue test.
All right.
Yeah, it does make for a good conversation piece, though, mm-hmm. the two-tone tree. Like
they can look very, very odd.
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Gloria and Suamico, on to you. Hi, Gloria.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, we live in an area in a woods that is very old growth, very, very
nice.
Mature pines, a little birch, oak, maples, and these trees are 80 to 90 feet tall, and it's very old growth. And we can't figure out why in the front of our property, which is about probably about an acre and a half where all these trees are, there are no pines coming through. There are small maples. There are small ash. There are small other trees that are coming up through the forest floor. But there are no pine trees, little pine trees coming up.
Well, it could be too shaded, first of all.
Okay.
Second of all, what kind of pines? White pines?
I think they're white pines.
Yeah, white pines are a little bit more shade, I don't want to say shade tolerant because they need full sun, but they can establish in the woods with new seedlings coming up. The second thing is pine seeds are highly prized by a number of animals, not just birds. And when they fall to the ground, I mean, it's kind of like a corn cob. I've seen squirrels just, you know, devour them. They just love them. That could be a reason as well. You can always plant some yourself, but if it's excessively shaded, you may have a little problem getting them to grow back.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Joyce and Hayward, let's go north. Hi, Joyce.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have three tomato plants in containers.
Okay.
And the leaves on two of them look kind of yellow, and they're curled, and they're on the lower branches. And I think it's a virus.
Is it pretty uniform yellowing on those lower leaves?
Right. And it seems that it's creeping up onto the upper branches too, and they just look really scrawny. Two of them look really scrawny. The other one looks a little better. Mm-hmm. So as I was reading, it said that it could be a virus and I should destroy the plant.
I'm more concerned that it may be a fertility issue that you're dealing with. If it's lower leaves and they're kind of uniformly turning yellow, it could be a nitrogen deficiency. That's a typical pattern. You tend to see it's a mobile nutrient, so the plants tend to steal it from the lower leaves and move it to the growing point to produce new foliage.
Uh-huh.
So you may want to get one of the vegetable fertilizers and get into a regular fertilization regime for those plants, particularly since they're in pots.
Okay.
One thing I want to mention, what kind of soil do you have?
They're in containers, and so I had bought potting soil from one of the local garden centers, and then I did use a little bit of the old soil from last year in the bottom.
Yeah, we usually don't recommend that.
Yeah, that's what, when I was doing it, was like, ooh, I don't know if I should be doing this. Mm-hmm.
Also, with tomatoes, you don't want to over-fertilize with
nitrogen
because you won't get as many fruit,
right?
First of all, and you'll get a lot of lush growth, which looks great.
That's why I recommend one of the fertilizers that's designed for vegetables, tomatoes.
There aren't many leaves.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, you know, it may be very difficult for you to get any fruit this year, but I think that's where I would start, would be with a good fertilization regime for those plants.
Do you have them in sun?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's good.
So you don't think it's a virus?
No, and usually what we...
If it is a virus, what can I do with the soil?
You basically remove the plants because the virus is going to be in the plant. The soil I would be a little bit cautious about as well. It depends on what virus, plant virus you're dealing with.
Uh-huh.
You would remove that as well, and then I would disinfest your pots. What kind of pots are you growing these in?
These are plastic.
Plastic pots.
Uh-huh. Sometimes... And I wash them every year with, like, bleach water.
Okay, that won't necessarily always take care of all viruses, and also it may not take care of, if you would get some certain types of root rots in your plants, it will not get rid of those organisms necessarily either. So it might be the time to consider replacing your pots as well.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. And Scott in Watertown up next. Scott, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an issue with a winged euonymus that I planted in the front of the house about 7 or 8 years ago. It was bald and burlap nursery stock. It's been absolutely gorgeous up until the spring. When the leaves were about half leafed out, they started to wilt. And over the course of the next couple weeks, they turned yellow and the whole bush just died uniformly, the whole thing. And I cut it down. I haven't pulled the stump out yet, and I'm wondering if it would be safe to put another burning bush in that same location. It is a little shady there, and the soil is not real well drained. It's a little heavy, but you know, the plant had done just perfect for 6 or 7, 8 years, and I'm wondering if it was some kind of a verticillium wilt or something possibly got into it.
The first thing that I think of is rabbits. Rabbits love burning bush. It's one of their very favorite things.
There was no evidence of any girdling or any
no chewing
or anything like that.
Okay.
I took a pretty good look. I dug down. I looked for girdling root. I had the gas company out because the gas meter is about 10 feet from it. Thought possibly there would have been a small gas leak in the ground.
The burlap and wire basket was removed at the time of planting?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
I went ahead and, of course, removed all that. It's in a raised landscaping bed where there's landscape fabric down, and then I think there's just some rock mulch there, which I know isn't the best.
Yeah,
but,
that is...
it had always done real good in the past.
That wouldn't be my recommendation around any plant, quite frankly. But it sounds like the sorts of things that I would think of first in terms of causing the death of that shrub, you've kind of ruled out. The other thing I have seen in a winged euonymus is a burning bush. I don't usually see verticillium. I've looked and looked and looked for that particular disease in that particular host and have never found it. What I do find is another fungus called Phomopsis. It's actually a canker organism, and I have seen that in the crown of these sorts of shrubs, and it's just it'll girdle the crowns, girdle the branches, and cause them to die back. I actually had a burning bush in my own yard that over about a two-year period, Phomopsis took out. So it's a fairly common pathogen that I see on that particular host.
Good look at it. I looked the whole bush over top to bottom. It was about 6 feet in diameter, mm-hmm. and there was no visible signs of anything. I'm thinking of doing this very carefully, excavating the rest of the roots out when I pull it out and seeing if there's something maybe I can look for there.
The Phomopsis you probably wouldn't see. When I've seen samples, you don't see a lot of a sunken area where the infection is, but if you incubate that material in a moist chamber, you get reproductive structures of the fungus that pop out pretty easily. Okay. I would definitely, though, examine the lower crown and the root system. It's definitely a possibility that there could be other types of root and crown rot organisms that are causing problems. Where are you located in the state again?
In Watertown.
In Watertown, okay. If you were a little farther north, I might worry about armillaria, which is another fungal disease, but a fungal pathogen. But I think that's probably unlikely in your area. Definitely take a look. If you have any problems, see anything that's looks odd, you're welcome to email me. And let me just give out my email. It's B as in boy, D as in David, H as in Harry, @ PlantPath, that's PlantPath, .wisc.edu.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Do you think it would be wise, if I did not find anything, would it be all right to maybe put another one in that same location, or do you think it's possible something in the soil that may...
I am concerned. You haven't told me anything that would definitely indicate that it's a soil problem, but I would be somewhat concerned, so I might be inclined to plant something different.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Scott. And Jay and Holman, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hello. Brian, your lab diagnosed a Japanese tree lilac that an arborist sent in with verticillium.
Yes, very common on that host.
Pardon?
Very common on that particular host.
It has another one that's in perfect condition, mm-hmm. 20 feet away from it, and they're sort of a matched set.
Yes.
And 20 feet from it on the other side is a sugar maple.
Mm-hmm.
How likely it is that both of those neighbors have been infected?
Possible. Are you seeing any branch dieback?
I haven't visited the site yet. I've been doing this by phone so far. It's 40 miles away.
That's what I would look for, would be kind of a sectional dieback in either one of those trees. And that's very typical of verticillium. It's a fungus that gets into the water conducting tissue and blocks it off. And so you tend to get a group of branches or a single branch in the tree that initially wilt or die back, and then it kind of moves through the rest of the tree. The two Japanese tree lilacs, if they would happen to have root grafted, there could have been movement through root grafts. But quite frankly, this is a soil-borne fungus that can get in through the roots on its own. So you likely have the fungus in your soil.
There could be an advantage to just removing the diseased one and trying to save the other two?
I do tend to recommend getting rid of the trees, although it's not as critical as with some other types of related diseases like Dutch elm disease or oak wilt. But I would suggest go ahead and get rid of the lilac. It's going to kill it off eventually. And I would burn, if you have that option, burn that material.
Yeah. And good luck. Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Laura and Brian, thank you so much. The time flew by.
Wow, that did flow
by. Did fly by.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you can do a little yard work, Laura, for this 4th of July weekend.
I'm actually going on vacation.
Good for you.
Yeah. To the UP, eh?
Hey, all right. Well, we've had some calls from Watertown today, and we'll be in Watertown for part of the weekend, and then here in Madison to watch the fireworks here. So fireworks in Watertown, fireworks in Madison.
All right.
Sounds great. Our agenda. Thank you guys very much.
You're welcome anytime.
Look forward to your next visit. Laura Jowell, associate professor and horticulturist in woody ornamentals from the UW, and Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.